Hello, my name is Dave Hanrady and there will be no encore. Welcome to episode 36 of the No Encore Music Podcast. I'm getting judging eyes from around this table, a very, very packed table this week. And I guess we'll start with my regular brethren. We'll start with Craig. What's Patrick?
Enter Sandhan. How goes it?
It's probably the worst nickname yet.
They're still teamed though, so I'm putting some effort in.
We're reviewing Metallica on this episode.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Very,
that
very
was
good.
The joke.
I just wanted to explain it, you know?
I'm already disappointed you didn't go with Han Unkind.
Oh.
That voice is Dave Higgins.
How does it feel to be alive?
Welcome back to the podcast, Dave.
Should we do
Thanks.
It?
Woo! Ow! Yeah. We need to get football rattles. Can we get a football rattle sound effect, please, Alan?
Excellent.
That's Cullen O'Regan.
How's it going?
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Good, yeah, not too bad.
It's good to have you back.
I didn't have a themed entrance like the two boys, but it's good to be here.
Well, how about you give our wrestling fan-loving friend who's sitting next to you a proper introduction? Because there's been some hints of this other person who's sitting next to me before on this very, very podcast.
There has. His name has been mentioned once or twice in passing, once or twice in long-form dwelling. We are delighted to say the repatriated from the Six, back in Ireland, and finally on No Encore, it's Josh Hughes.
Yeah!
And he's brought Drake.
It's Joshua Hughes.
I was running through the Six with my walk.
Do I really deserve that much of an intro?
No. Fuck no.
We'll see, I guess, would be the answer.
Well, yeah, based on my performance today.
Welcome home, though. You're back from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
2.5 years. In prison.
In prison, yeah.
What'd you learn?
Not much. Break a chair over someone's back the first night, and you're pretty much good. Canadians are quite good that way. They're polite.
He apologized for breaking the chair. Hey, did I get in your way?
They apologized to me for making me do it. That's so good there.
Okay, before we get going, some things to talk about. Last week, myself, Craig and Dave Higgins and Craig's sister went to see a David Lynch film in the Lighthouse Cinema.
Yeah, that wasn't awkward at all.
That film was Lost Highway.
Real nice family movie.
Yeah, it really was. I forgot all of the violent sex scenes.
Of which there are a lot.
It was about 90% of the film. So I sat next to my 19-year-old sister.
Yeah, Vinny Casey of Overhead the Albatross fame was there.
Yeah.
He thought you were on a date.
He did.
But it wasn't a date because it was your sister.
I would have been even
weirder.
Had Vinny
put his pants on since the hot press shoot?
Oh,
because
no.
I saw that behind the scenes photo earlier and it's kind of scarred me.
No, he hadn't. So it was a very strange cinema experience.
He's banned from the Lighthouse Cinema and most of Dublin. But yeah, I just wanted to bring that up just to make Craig feel a little bit more awkward again.
Okay, yeah, mission accomplished. Let's get on with the podcast.
Is there another family outing from Holland Drive?
I think there might be.
Okay.
Depends if she's not too scared.
Oh, there's no sex scenes in that.
Not at all.
Yeah, but it'll be kind of light entertainment compared to last week. Anyway.
Well, other cinema entertainment, I saw Arrival, which is the kind of big sci-fi movie of the moment. Dave Higgins also saw it. And when I went to see it, like, you know, I've noted before that, you know, I can be a bit of an emotional guy. And the ending of Arrival really hit me in the feels, as they say. And, you know, sitting in the draw to cinema.
So your testicles.
A couple of tears streaming down. Very, very good movie. I really, really enjoyed it. The use of music in it is actually particularly great. Max Richter's score. But Dave.
Johan Johansson?
Well, Max Richter was used for the main kind of motif.
Oh, okay.
On The Nature of Daylight. Yeah, get it right, film critic. But you're right, Johan Johansson did do the score. Yeah. Nonetheless.
Lads, take it outside. Come on.
Dave Higgins also saw the movie and noted to me in a pretty spectacular WhatsApp message that it was now the film that almost made you cry the most.
Yeah, so it has usurped Up and The Shawshank Redemption.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Because you don't cry at films, because you're a big tough guy.
It's nothing to do with being tough, it's just, I can well up, but, you know, for something to extract the tears from me, it just takes something a little bit more that, you know, Arrival didn't have.
Well, it had it for someone.
Yeah, so I was sitting down in the lighthouse, I had my scarf just beside me. There was plenty of space and someone came along, I was like, can I sit down there? I was like, yeah, no problem. My girlfriend turned to me and was like, do you know who that is? And I was like, no. And she's like, that's Ellen Page. And I was like, it's probably not. So, yeah, I didn't stare at her because I'm not a weird person. But towards the end of the movie had ended. And at the point where most people with a heart apparently were crying, I was getting ready to leave. I just took a little glance to my right and she was bawling crying. So there you go.
Well, I'm disappointed that you didn't take the opportunity to tell her that Juno is the worst film of all time.
I feel like it would have been a low blow at, you know.
It wasn't really her fault, though, was it?
It wasn't really the time.
I guess not. Colm, you went to a wedding.
I did.
Did you stay up for the McGregor fight on the same night?
No, I didn't. Well, I mean, I stayed up that late, but we didn't watch the McGregor fight. That was presumably around the point at which I was like, I'll do a song. But it was a wonderful wedding, yes. Congratulations to my friend Katie.
Congratulations, Katie.
Wonderful setting. Before you move on from this whole cinema talk, last night, if something was going to push me to tears, it would be the fact that I will never in my life feel the happiness that my girlfriend did watching the latest chapter of the Harry Potter film thing.
Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, I believe.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was saying thing because, like, it's not quite the Harry Potter franchise. Yeah, it's the Wizarding World or whatever, as they call it. But, basically, Nina was happier than I've ever made her and ever will manage to do. So
that's the end of the relationship then?
Well, no, it just...
Eddie Redmayne wins again.
His reign of terror continues. Can't say I'm a fan of that franchise or spin-off franchise indeed, but I hear it's a bit of fun. I don't know.
It's a bit of crap.
Well, let's get into something that was the opposite of fun. You may have been wondering, compose yourself, Craig. You may have been wondering why in the last episode of No Encore we didn't address the death of Leonard Cohen. It's because that occurred, or at least was announced, hours after the show was recorded last week. So I made a Leonard Cohen reference in the Robbie Williams review that I'll regret for the rest of my life, although I was still praising the man indeed. So Craig, take us through how we all found out about this, because it broke at a really odd time.
Yeah, I'm still recovering from that segue. It broke kind of in the middle of the night. I was on earlies, as I seem to constantly be these days. So kind of woke up in a daze, still dark out, just saw it online, and yeah, it sounds strange to say unexpected, because he was an 82-year-old man that had just written an album about debt and had said that, yeah, I'm pretty much ready to die. And I was still like, wait, what? He's dead? It was a strange one. But yeah, very sad news.
Yeah, I did have a little bit of that myself. A big Leonard Cohen fan. But as I say, like he kind of warned us in that letter to the original Marianne not so long ago. He kind of said that he wasn't going to be far behind her. And what's more, I read a lot of people, obviously, that day when, you know, it's just everybody's writing about it. And I thought Beth Orton came out with an opening line that I certainly connected with. And she said, it was a grief I can process, which was almost the way that I looked at it. That unlike some of the other deaths that, you know, we've seen in the music world and indeed, you know, across the world in this year, this one maybe made a little bit more sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it still hit like a fucking ton of bricks, though, because you were just like, really? Like, really? Another horrific thing this year, really?
Sure.
Okay, great.
It does seem as kind of graceful an exit as you could imagine.
Completely.
Do you know what I mean? And he seemed very in control, and he'd made his peace with it, which makes it, I guess, easier.
Adam Cohen's statement about it was actually quite well written. He said, my sister and I just buried my father in Montreal with only immediate family and a few lifelong friends present. He was lowered into the ground in an... why would you open a beer?
You told me that I wasn't allowed to open a beer until we were recording, Dave.
He was lowered into the ground in an unadorned pine box next to his mother and father, exactly as he'd asked. As I write this, I'm thinking of my father's unique blend of self-deprecation and dignity. Dignity that was robbed by you opening a beer there, Colin. His approachable elegance, his charisma without audacity, his old-world gentlemanliness, and the hand-forged terror of his work. There's so much I wish I could thank him for just one last time. I thank him for the comfort he always provided, for the wisdom he dispensed, for the marathon conversations, for his dazzling wit and humour. I thank him for giving me and teaching me to love Montreal and Greece. And I thank him for his music. First for his music, which seduced me as a boy. Then for his encouragement of my own music. And finally, for the privilege of being able to make music with him. Thank you for your kind messages, for the outpouring of sympathy, and for your love of my father. And it has been a massive outpouring, as you would expect. And it is kind of one of those things that, like, a lot of people have reacted, you know, very, very elegantly themselves. There was two excellent pieces on Headstuff Music, one written by Craig Fitzpatrick about Leonard Cohen. It was a lovely, lovely piece. When I read it first, Craig, I said to you as well, I said in a private message, which I'm now going to share with the listeners.
Oh, go for it.
I said that when I read it, I felt very sad. And then by the end of it, I smiled. It was perfectly bittersweet. And also, it concludes with a playlist, by the way, of over 2 hours of Leonard Cohen's music throughout the era, handpicked by Craig. So what went into your choices there?
Well, I initially had a playlist that I was just kind of dipping into every week prior to his death anyway. So it was just a kind of chronological thing, picking his best tracks from album to album, but I kind of just switched it up because just the consistency of his work across the decades meant that you didn't have a kind of, you know, usually when you see someone's best of, it's just like diminishing returns. Yeah. Even as his styles changed, there was, you know, the kind of authority of his voice and the themes he touched on, even as a kind of younger man in his 30s, held true and I guess became truer as you face mortality and things like that. So it just seemed like it was crying out to be mixed up a bit and see the kind of proper breadth of his work. So that's just what I was thinking. It wasn't really too scientific. It was just stuff I loved. So yeah, that was it.
I listened to Come Healing on repeat that morning as I got ready and have to say, not on the playlist, Craig. So, you know, 9 out of 10 for the playlist.
No, like, it's about 2 hours and 20 minutes. I could have just kept going, but it's like that, even that was a long playlist for someone just dipping in, I think.
True enough. And, I mean, we didn't cover You Want It Darker, his farewell address, on the podcast for, I don't know why, we just, for whatever reason, didn't. So we've all kind of been catching up on it this week in, you know, kind of in the wake of the news. So, Dave Higgins, what's your take on it?
I'm really digging it, and I think that what you were saying about Craig's piece, that you started sad and kind of ended up feeling happy, there's like an element to that listening to You Want It Darker. It's very rare that an artist can kind of call their final shot on what they do. I think you'd mentioned in your piece about the David Remnick piece in The New Yorker, where he was talking to Leonard Cohen. One of the things he said, that putting your house in order, if you can do it, is one of the most comforting activities. And I kind of feel like this album was that. It was kind of him just crossing the T's and getting everything kind of sorted for himself.
Yeah, but doing so in a very, you know, Leonard Cohen kind of way. I think it's a wonderful record. I like the brevity of it in particular, and I think it's just really kind of, it's just a really, really good statement. I mean, it's difficult to listen to in certain respects because it's very frank. But at the same time, when you come to the end of it, there's just such a sense of acceptance and a sense of almost kind of like celebration for the life that he's led. It's not faint praise to say that he went out on an incredibly high note. He definitely did. Cullum?
As well, it's kind of reflective of, I guess, the last sort of, you know, 8-10 years of his life, where I think when he went back on stage, when he went back on tour, and luckily we got a chance to see it in Ireland a lot, I think he had already played like 10 or 12 shows here over the course of kind of 4 or 5 years, and I was lucky enough to be there for 2 of them. Incredible performances, but it very much was the case that, you know, he heard so much about his financial troubles, and obviously, you know, he'd spent a while out of the spotlight, like I say, 15 years without playing a gig. He spent 5 of those in a monastery in LA, like neither sight nor sound. And, you know, seeing him back there, and I guess still his enigmatic self in one way, but also a very, very human, very charming, very funny, very entertaining, and very true individual. Probably gave people a better sense of who he was in the latter stages of his career, I feel.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, it's that thing of, like, there's a kind of tone of resignation about the album, but it's like a victorious resignation. It's quite comforting. I mean, he's dealing with very scary stuff, but as opposed to maybe Johnny Cash's later day work or Bowie's album, I suppose, towards the start of the year, where it still seemed like this faraway thing of like mortality and, you know, approaching this vast, you know, thing you can't even comprehend. Well, Leonard seemed much more kind of grounded and based in reality, and he was as much telling himself that everything was kind of fine and things work out the way they are as the listener. So yeah, it's a difficult but mostly comforting listen, which is strange.
Josh, where does Leonard Cohen rank in your pantheon of artists?
I thought you were going to ask him for his pantheon of Canadians.
Oh, I should have done that. Oh yeah, so some people
just
were
below
like,
Drake.
Louise Mensch was like, you know, oh, Leonard Cohen's passing shows us just how dignified Americans can really be. Showing us how fucking dumb Louise Mensch can really be. But no, Josh.
I was kind of struck by it, actually, because in the statement it's like, teaching me how to love Montreal.
Or Montreal, as it's probably.
Because it's a kind of a shithole, so you would have to be taught to love Montreal.
Expand on that point, won't you, for our Canadian listeners?
I'm curious at this, because Montreal's the nicest place, and I've lived in Vancouver that I've ever been in Canada.
Ooh, really?
I was only there a day. It was lovely.
Well, you were probably in old Montreal, for the most part.
Montreal's earlier work was much better.
yeah, exactly was. So there's Montreal is like broken up into like there's like old Montreal, which is like the bit that like the French built, and it has really nice architecture, and it's along the river, and it's really, really nice. The rest of it is horrific. It's just this gray, like it could be like part of the Soviet bloc. Like when you're coming near, it's just sorry, I'm like having a real go here at a whole
please.
City.
You're never going back to that country.
A literal international incident here. In terms of like my sort of top artists, I suppose I probably wouldn't know enough of his back catalog.
Would you put him above Drake, would you?
No, in terms of Canadian artists, I have to say Drizzy has done more in recent years,
more
at the very least.
Fuck,
more culturally relevant, you might say, than Leonard.
You're not going to find Leonard Cohen lint rolling his pants at a game.
Exactly. Exactly, Dave. I'm thinking he hit the nail on the head.
Jake's a man of the people, is what you're saying.
He is.
You actually might have, though, to be honest.
A funny thing about that piece in New Yorker as well is that he said that he used to work in a clothes factory, so he always knew how to fold his clothes. So whenever he performed on stage, no creases, always immaculate his suits. So
there you go.
See?
Yeah, I bet he didn't, fucking kowtow to whatever city he was in with a different basketball jersey.
Probably
but nonetheless,
not.
What did you think of this album?
I thought it was really good. And the point that I was sort of going to raise was thematically and sort of situationally even how similar it was to the Bowie record. Mm-hmm. Because it was two artists and two like giant kind of artists literally writing about their impending sort of death, which is a sort of unique situation in terms of like the history of this kind of level of artist. I will say that I kind of didn't find it as comforting as maybe the rest of the table found. In particular, You Want It Darker is sort of saying that like if God's the dealer, well then he doesn't want to be a part of the game. Which is sort of a real sort of terrifying statement. Like he doesn't want to be involved with life, like if God's the dealer, like. But overall I thought it was a great album, but I found it to be less comforting, I guess, than
I think one thing that maybe gave the comfort is that, you know, when he makes a statement like that, it does actually sound like he's figured it out, as it were. And I think as well, that kind of goes back to, you know, when he came back from a break from recording music, from break from playing live music, and kind of resumed a sort of a second chapter in his career. There's almost a feeling now as though, like, you know, there wasn't a stone left unturned in the Leonard Cohen story.
Yeah.
That, you know, if that had been it, if he'd gone into that Buddhist retreat and that was the end of Leonard Cohen, then we would definitely be sitting here looking at a collection of records from the 70s and 80s going, gosh, what might have been.
Sure.
Whereas, you know, I think we kind of got a second chapter, as it were, kind of a second coming and bonus Cohen. Almost in a way, you know,
through nefarious means when he's made bankrupt by
a little bit. Yeah. I mean, unfortunate circumstances to bring it about, but I mean, anybody who was, like I say, I mean, those gigs, were you in Kilmainham, Craig?
Yeah,
was,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that was that was insane. The only way that I can describe it to people is remember that scene from Willy Wonka in the Chocolate Factory where he comes out and he's like the feeble old man on a stick.
He
looks
roll.
Like he's about to collapse, and then it's a forward roll. Yeah, that was Cohen that night.
Yeah.
He came out 70 odd years old, and you were thinking, what are we in store for here? And about half an hour later, he's got, like, you know, doffing his cap at his backing singers and, like, you know, shaking his hips to the crowd. And you're just like, holy shit, this is awesome.
Yeah. I deeply, deeply regret not going to see him live. I had many opportunities and I just didn't go. And anyone I know who's been has said it was like a religious experience. So that's a shame. But what can you do?
Nothing. Yeah. He's dead.
Let's move on.
We'll move on to more alive artists. That's a terrible segue. I can't do that. That's awful. Move on to one man who is very much kind of, you know, carrying the ball on his own terms as well, and someone who wouldn't want to have any posthumous releases come out should he drop dead. Frank Ocean, you know, big fan of Frank Ocean at the entire table, I believe, yeah? Yeah?
Yes, we're all on board.
He's given a rare interview, his first proper interview since the release of Endless and Blonde with the New York Times. The New York Times gets fucking everybody.
Yeah.
The hell?
I swear they're a big newspaper.
Yeah. I swear they're like really prestigious.
What are the Times doing? I don't
know. So yeah, Frank has spoken about a myriad of subjects, and he's kind of reaffirmed the confidence that we believe that he has, and kind of says that he thinks he's the best at what he does. And, you know, he talked about the Grammy situation where he withheld his album. He said he did it on purpose, said he'd rather this be his Colin Kaepernick moment for the Grammys than sit there in the audience.
Kaepernick.
I knew I pronounced that wrong, and I'm glad that my American sports loving friends were
well, that's
too.
Why I'm the American sports enthusiast. Why do you that's why you guys bring me here.
Why don't you take the rest of this fucking news story, Dave? Yeah? Yeah? No, he's not going to. I'm going to do it. So, yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's Frank being fairly cagey, but also being open at the same time. In his
it's kind of Frank being Frank.
It's Frank
really,
being Frank,
it?
Essentially, yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know. I want to ask you guys, if this is what a Frank Ocean interview looks like, are you kind of happy enough to just let it be and not have to hear from him?
Yeah, I know. That's the sense I got. I mean, it's a really well-written piece. By the end of it, I was just kind of thinking, did they speak for about 7 minutes?
What I remembered about...
So there was some good quotes, but there was very little substance, really. Or you don't get to the essence of him whatsoever.
Yeah, really. And what's more, it just makes what we kind of thought about him just seem stunningly mundane and thought out or something like
yeah,
that, you know, when
yeah.
it's just written down in black and white. What I was reminded of is, you know, those people who are obsessed with seeing Daft Punk without their helmets? And it's just like, well, this is going to add nothing to your enjoyment, and it could well take away from it. So why do you bother?
Yeah.
And that's kind of almost how I felt about this, because, yeah, you know, I mean, like, we knew that Frank felt a bit disillusioned with the industry. We knew that he likes to go away and do things very much on his own terms. We guessed, though we didn't know for a fact, that it was kind of talking to old friends and stuff that had stirred up some of the emotions that fueled Blonde. We knew, really, that the release of Endless was a kind of a trick to get out of his last record contract. And then, yeah, we just had the New York Times tell us.
But again, in an era in which there's no mystery, I'm happy to have some mystery. I mean, even like, you know, the takeaway quotes aren't that impressive. It's like, you know, he talks about singing in multiple voices. And he's like, sometimes it felt like you weren't hearing enough versions on me within a song because there was a lot of hyperactive thinking. Even though the pace of the album is not frenetic, the pace of ideas being thrown out is. So it's like, fair enough. I guess that makes sense. But I do like the thing where he says, you know, he always carries his hard drives with him on planes. He
said, that is good.
That was really
I'd rather the plane goes down in flames and the drives go down with me than somebody put out a weird posthumous release. Which again,
goes, I can understand that.
Goes some way to his level of control, and yeah, I mean, ultimately, I mean, well, Leonard Cohen, I don't really want any new music now. I think that's a great full stop, and I don't want to hear, you know, we found 27 new songs.
Yeah, I agree.
That stuff's always kind of weird, but yeah, I mean, we're gonna be doing our albums of the year and our songs of the year very, very soon on No Encore, and you know. I'm not going to give away anything that I haven't already given away on Twitter, but Blonde is up there.
Yeah, it is. And as well, he's done himself no harm by using the word lanyap.
I love that word. Yeah, yeah, that was great.
Absolutely fantastic. Well done, Frank.
The one takeaway from the interview seemed to be that like we could be waiting an even longer while for the next release because he seems very much to be, you know, I'm the best at music, so I might just move on.
And he goes, yeah, I don't really need to think in terms of albums anymore. I can do it whatever way I want to do it. But I also liked the bit where like there was a thing about how Zane Lowe apparently has interviewed him. And he was like, you know, me and Frank are friends. And he goes, we're such good friends. I can just hop on FaceTime and chat to him. And it was like, this is desperate. And he said that he goes, Frank called me up one day and was like, get on a plane, come out, do the interview. And he's like, I just winged it, you know, it was great.
Off to Tokyo, wasn't it?
And then he was like, I don't know when it's going to come out, or if it is going to come out. And it was like, Zane Lowe, you don't come across cool here, man.
You missed a trick there.
You don't come across good, man. But yeah, so Cullum, in legal news.
In legal news.
It's going to be a regular segment.
Yeah, and hand over to the man who used to date a lawyer, Cullum Morrigan. No, I was actually going to say, when you mentioned posthumous releases, they're very much causing problems as far as Prince and his estate is concerned. They signed a deal with Universal that would kind of give them full publishing rights for his music, both pre-released and what's to come. And they're now suing Roc Nation, saying that Tidal have been illegally streaming the late musician's catalogue. They signed a kind of an exclusive thing for his Hit and Run Phase 1 LP, but then added a load more after his death. And yeah, that is the subject of this suit. I mean, this isn't the first time that we've heard stuff about Prince's estate and Prince's music rights being debated over the past couple of months. It's almost definitely not going to be the last. It's just a bit sad, really, isn't it?
It is. It's more bad news for Tidal and bad publicity. But
will you be a character witness for Tidal?
Sure. My time with Tidal was grand. It was great.
This isn't a deposition now.
Oh, okay. You'll have time. Is this on the record?
No.
If you publish this?
I don't know. Well, if Roc Nation's listening.
But this is all over kind of 15 lesser-known Prince albums that probably not a lot of people were looking for anyway, so you're not really talking about huge amounts of cash or even, I don't know, it's probably tied up in this Universal deal, obviously. It is interesting because Prince was such an outspoken fan of Tidal. He was very much, you know, on board with that sentiment that Tidal was a service that was run by artists for kind of artists and was given a bit of power back to artists. So I don't know if he'd be in agreement with this kind of, you know, what is an estate going after him, because he seemed to be a big kind of cheerleader for
which
him.
Is an amazing turnaround from someone who once declared that the internet was dead and gave away copies of his album with the Daily Mail.
Yeah, so
because Prince is alive and well.
But it does seem like his estate isn't really acting the way Prince might have acted.
Well, the estate situation, like, I mean, it looks pretty grim when you kind of read that the legal battle over the rights to his catalogue, courts are still narrowing down the musician's legal heirs, which to me just like speaks of boardrooms and people who are like, you know, trying to get a pound of flesh. And that's not what you really want to remember Prince like, but it must be an absolute nightmare.
The kind of interest.
Paisley Park is already a fucking theme park type museum situation.
Yeah, it's like the new Graceland. The interesting thing is, for a guy that was so obsessed with controlling his music and his image and stuff like that, and, you know, a vocal kind of outspoken person against the record industry, he didn't have like a proper will. He had no kind of plans put in place to take care of this after he passed. I guess people don't like to think about their own demise, which is understandable, but it just seems like such a mess and not something you would have wanted.
No, and something that Father John Misty didn't want was when an American Idol is it, or X Factor,
The Voice,
The Voice.
Moved on to The Voice.
Could have kept going, man. Like, I dropped a Fame Academy.
Fame Academy. Yeah,
last
yeah,
week.
You're a star.
You're a star.
Pop Stars Arrivals.
Basically, a meaningless pop competition to get judges over more than get the actual new next voices over. Some guy called Aaron Gibson did a cover of Father John Misty's song that we all like called Hollywood Forever Cemetery Sings. Let's have a listen to the original by Father John Misty. What are people gonna think when I show up to one of several funerals I've attended for Grandpa this week with you, with me? Someone's gotta Okay, great song. Let's have a listen to Aaron Gibson's version. Jesus Christ, girl, what are people gonna think when I show up to one of several funerals I've attended for Grandpa this way with you, with me? Someone's gotta help me, babe. Oh, someone's gotta help me, babe. So what do we think?
Now, you see, I saw Father John Misty's reaction to this, where he opened with, why, no, God, why?
Stick to the point.
Basically, I was expecting an abomination. I was thinking that he turned it into a synth pop number or something like that. I mean,
actually sounds kind of good.
That would have been a lot better.
I mean, like, it's grand. It's a low rent cover, but
it's perfectly passable.
Hold on. Like, I thought, like, because I was like about to speak, as Colin was about to speak, and I was like, oh, he's making my point, which is. When I read Father John Misty's statement, I was like, Jesus, he's clearly overreacting. But then I heard it, and it's like, he's clearly not. It's the worst thing I've ever heard.
Really?
Ooh. Yeah. He's absolutely destroyed.
I mean, there's no reason for it to exist, but I don't think it's offensive. Oh. As those shows go, I mean, it just sounds like a shitty Dave Matthews, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And spiced with kind of Creed.
If it was Creed, hang on, the first line is, Jesus Christ, girl. If it was Creed, it would have been My Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, girl.
Bonus pop quiz that references my bad teenage CD collection. How many Creed albums did I own?
3.
If you own more than just Human Clay, I don't even know anymore.
No, you had Weathered as well.
Craig said 3.
I'm going to go 2.
2.
Well, I'm going to think 3 now.
And the winner is Craig!
Wow. Nailed it. More than just Human Clay should be the pod title, by the way.
My Own Prison, Human Clay, and Weathered.
Jesus.
Good God.
Mind you,
it's a dark time for you, man.
I had Human Clay, by the way.
Yeah. I actually think
and I had Weathered, so there you go.
Scott Stapp might have done a good job of Hollywood referencing new things. I'd be interested to hear that.
Would you, though?
Yeah.
Someone's gotta help me, dear.
See?
Yeah, well, I finally got him back on the internet because he's been, he ran
off. Oh, apologize, I missed you. I think Scott Stapp. I was like, what? Like, well, last time he was in there, he filmed a sex video with Kid Rock. No one needs that.
Wait, what?
Don't hear about that.
No, I'm pretty sure.
Can we put this as a post-pod sidebar?
I'm pretty sure that this is all good, Alan. If not, get the bleep out. You don't get sued by Scott. Imagine a legal writ from Scott Stapp, from the estate of Scott Stapp and Kid Rock of Creed and being awful fame.
And on the chances that we don't get sued or believe that this is dodgy legal territory, it sounded like this.
The sex tape?
No, of course not.
I didn't know that was referencing.
I think we can move on to things that are actually reasonable to listen to.
Before we do, yes, as Craig says, Father John Misty, I like Father John Misty's ridiculous statement. He had a change of heart after deleting the Facebook post where he was giving out about it. And he put up a couple of Facebook posts and he said, I'm happy for anyone to sing any of my songs, and it is more important now than ever that we not be apathetic about who we vote on for a game show. And he said, we must uphold the dignity of the American democratic process no matter how little we like the performers therein.
What do you think he's referring to?
I don't think there's any subtext whatsoever.
He's not loaded at all.
Problematic, Father John Misty, for a lot of people. I'm a fan.
I'm a massive fan. I don't think this is the battle he needs to be fighting.
No.
You know.
I think it was.
Josh is truly appalled by this.
I was extremely upset by this cover.
From one Joshua to another.
Evidently. Well, let's see if we can find something a little more palatable. All right. Amongst our songs of the week.
We're going to go random number game, I think.
Oh.
So who wants to go first?
Me. I will.
Oh.
I'm going to pick number three, Dave.
I was going to go for three.
Well, then you didn't need to go, did you?
Okay. Number three is a song that I was reticent to get into this week due to the Conor McGregor artwork that accompanied it. This is Mango. He's from Dublin. It's called What Are You Saying? Now, what are you saying? Lads chat about trends I don't care about. Clap tracks you used to wear them out. No one the best dressed rapper in the city. You should see what the fuck Mango was wearing now. No comparing now. My new tunes, your crew's blaring now. They bite my style and they ride my hype because I get Dublin crowns Larry now. Fuck a rap, I'll tear it down. Big man DM, you wear the belts. Just pull up and stare them down with a smile on my channel like I dare to clown. You're like the wordy now. What am I scared of now? Wasn't getting that boy before. I think you lot are faker than a truck. Yeah, it's barely hell. Better watch that lip. Like, what are you saying? Wanna talk that shit? Come on. Like, what are you saying? And I'll pop back quick. All right, Cullum, you jumped the gun here. So why don't you take us away?
Yeah, so this is Mango. He was part of a collective up until not so long ago. Now branching out on his own. I know Mathman actually produced this, and he's done some very good stuff, Hypnotic Brass Ensemble recently, where he actually had them doing vocals, and it was pretty good. The beat of this is good. It's substance-wise, it's lacking a little for me.
I think it sounds like any kind of random rap song. It draws a lot from the sounds of other countries. Mm-hmm. I think it sounds a lot like it could have come from Britain, or it has elements of kind of trap music about it. And then kind of in terms of the content of it, there's nothing especially sort of Irish about it, which is one of the things that I've always found kind of quite disappointing about the Irish rap scene. And the only thing that's recognizably Irish about it is his accent. Mm. And I would like to see more Irish rappers kind of bringing about more of originality. That said, I think this is perfectly listenable.
Yeah, this is fine. I mean, I think, you know, in terms of, we had a grime track on recently, and I think, you know, this is kind of skirting a similar kind of vibe, and I think this is much better than the Section Boys, was that what you had? With Skepta. This is fine. I quite like it. I think the production's good. I quite like it more when it goes into more kind of, not so much a dancey vibe, but there's like a kind of a good synth thing going on towards the end. I think the use of a silenced pistol for percussion is a bit played out.
Oh man,
wasn't really into that so much, but no, it's perfectly fine. Like, it's done fairly well, it charted fairly well, and I mean, I'll be looking forward to see what he does next, but yeah, like, it's I'm thumbs in the middle really for me.
What do we think of the Adidas zip up that he's wearing?
I like
in the
it
video?
It's great. I like it a lot. Oh,
yeah, and apparently he's obsessed with Adidas.
He notes that he's like the best dressed rapper in Dublin. And you know, to be fair, you know, yeah,
I'm ready to give him that crown.
I think he's got style.
I believe his Twitter bio says that he rhymes to pay for his Adidas. So
it's a slick zip up hoodie. You're not into Josh, no? Josh is very sartorially snobbish. I feel like I should point out Josh believes that there's a certain way that everyone should look.
Wow.
Jesus.
I don't mean like that. I mean like in terms of
Lord.
In terms of clothing and
Josh's
right
middle names
fascist,
are Hugh and Jenix.
Threads. I meant threads.
I believe the sentence we're looking for is that everybody should dress a certain way. That's not that everybody should look a certain way.
That's what I meant, yeah.
I quite dig this actually. I really like the production by Mathman. It kind of reminds me a little bit of the first some of the sections of the first ASAP Ferg album, Trap Lord. I think he's got a really good flow. I agree with you, I do kind of wish that it wasn't just the kind of stock braggadocious rhyme, even though I do think he's quite good in that. I kind of wish that it kind of folded a little bit more to bring you into something that is Irish, although there's some good lines in it. I'm a big fan of Big Man, DM your whereabouts. It's going to be my new threat for just about everyone.
That is good, yeah.
Yeah, it's perfectly fine. I think the production's the best thing about it, really. I mean, you know, as you guys were saying, it's just a little cliched. And I didn't know about the artwork, but yeah, I was thinking, listening to it, this sounds like probably what the inside of Conor McGregor's head sounds like. And that's not necessarily a good thing for me.
That plus lots of air horns,
yeah,
I would say.
I mean, yeah, we're still waiting for that kind of very unique, I think, Dublin voice in hip-hop. Because, as Josh says, they're taking so many cues from across the Atlantic, and this isn't really it, even if he sounds kind of a bit like a young Ronnie Drew. It's just the voice, and there's nothing, there's no real kind of slant on life that, you know.
Well, as, you know, vague Conor McGregor tie-ins go, it's a damn sight better than that fucking original Rude Boys thing from a couple of years ago. May they rest in peace. Okay, who's next? Josh, pick a number.
4.
All right. This marks our third week in a row with a bit of a straight-up no-frills rock-out song. This is Pissed Jeans. The bar is low. Yeah, I tend to avoid bands with terrible monikers, and
this interviewed Holy Fuck the other week.
That's not a terrible moniker.
All right. It's not great.
It's better than this.
Bit try hard.
Better than this. I'm ham.
It is. It is better than Piss Jeans. Yeah.
The point is, right? We had Japan Droids, we had Los Campesinos in successive weeks there. This kind of goes into a similar furrow for me. A bit more raw, though. I really like this. I think this is fucking great. It had me pretty much from the off when that guitar came in. I think it's really raw and fun. I think it's, you know, it's the kind of song you'd expect a bar brawl to break out around you. And hopefully you wouldn't get hit by a flying bottle.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed it. I think this is great. And it's classic fucking sub pop as well. Like, it's very perfectly in with that label. And it's a thumbs up from me.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't really kept up to speed with what sub pop are doing. So it seems like they're really flying the flag for them. Certainly in terms of what I've heard. It is that classic sound. If it sounds a little dated now, I don't know. But yeah, like a great fun band. It's kind of, you know, it appeals to your lizard brain a bit. And I do think Mark Corvette is probably the standout element, because there's not a huge amount going on in this song. You wouldn't say they're doing anything particularly original or new.
No, but
he's
talk
a kind of charismatic dude.
We talk about how, like, there's no good guitar bands around anymore.
Yeah,
but this
it's
is like this
direct
is a raw
to the point. It's enjoyable. I don't think, like, the switch up around 2 minutes in, I don't think it quite pays off the way maybe it could have.
Or indeed the way that I think they maybe imagined that it was going to.
Yes,
because before that, it is monotonous for me. I wasn't a huge fan. It's funny you should mention that the second the guitar comes in, it had you. It kind of had me too, and I was like, you know, all right, let's go here. And then it never really went anywhere. It felt like a Hives riff that never actually kind of came to fruition, as it
sure,
were,
yeah.
that just chugged along in these kind of monotonous circles. Not very impressive to me, Dave.
Yeah, I remember them being a couple of years ago when they brought out Honeys, being kind of, there was a bit of buzz about that, and yeah. It was always one of those records that I just never really got around to. And after listening to this, like, yeah, like, it's good to hear a guitar band, and like, there's
Dave with the Haribo in the middle of the podcast. Super mix.
It's for everybody.
What's more, we're about 70 seconds from another clip. Yeah, and you were like,
I just couldn't hold on.
I did it off mic. I brought sweets for everybody. Help yourself.
And
sorry.
This is the thanks you get.
Sorry, Dave, continue, please.
Yeah, so, yeah, not really doing it for me. It kind of, it reminds me of a not very good at all McCluskey. McCluskey being great, but yeah, the best thing I've seen about them so far is their promo shots where they took them in front of the Kurt Vile mural in Philadelphia. So
that's yeah.
I'll pretty much kind of go along with everybody else. I'm kind of in the middle. I like the kind of strip back sort of sub pop sound. I like the guitar, but then I agree with Cullum that it doesn't really sort of go anywhere. It's like a fun single, but wouldn't
yeah,
be.
Yeah, enjoyable. Yeah. Craig, it's your turn for a number. And would you like a sweet?
No, I'm fine, thanks. And I'm going to go for number 5.
All right. Fitting that I'm chewing on a sweet here, because this is sugar. Bubblegum Pop. I don't even know what to say.
So professional.
He's lost the run, ladies and gentlemen. It is sugar pop at its best.
At its best?
Or its worst.
We'll
it's
find
Noah
out.
Cyrus, along with Labyrinth, and it's called Make Me Cry. Like I do right now. I never hated you like I do right now. 'Cause all you ever do is make me cry. That wasn't me suddenly running out of breath introducing that song. The Cry is in parenthesis. It's Make Me Cry.
Who's Noah Cyrus? What's he about?
Noah Cyrus is, in fact, a lady.
Oh, right.
And it's Miley Cyrus's sister.
Get out of town.
16-year-old sister.
Who'd have thunk?
Ready to launch a pop career.
Yeah, which was literally announced hours before the single was shared.
Yeah.
God knows where they found the time to record it, I guess. Yeah, this is her first single. I mean, to borrow a gag from Entourage, is she going to have to sit with Dom Swayze and Joey Travolta and the other retarded star siblings?
Whoa. I mean, she could be like Danny to Miley's Kylie Minogue-wise, couldn't she?
Yeah.
I don't know. Probably not on, well, actually, maybe on the basis of this track, because it's very of the moment, isn't it? It's actually hooky enough, like it's well written, but the production is just crap.
The thing is, I'm not sure just what moment it is, because like I can remember Labyrinth doing a song with Emily Sandé, like this is clear 4 years ago now, I'd say.
Yeah.
Is it You're Beautiful or Inside You're Beautiful?
Which it had a massive hit. Yeah,
it
so
had
maybe
an apostrophe
it's a 2012
missing. That's all I can really remember about it. But yeah, it sounded exactly like this. This is his trick, and clearly it's why he's been brought in as the kind of crutch on which she can promote herself straight off the bat.
She's trying really hard to sound like Lana Del Rey, I thought. Like a cross between Lana Del Rey and Miley Cyrus. That said, I mean, I think it's like a fun enough song. It's not as based on the lineup going in, it's not as bad as I was expecting.
It's good. It's fine. It's kind of pop song that gets kind of overblown immediately by some corners of the music press. It's enjoyable. It's a good first start. I don't like the use of a teardrop sound effect.
And it's not a teardrop.
It's water.
It's like a leaky tap.
Yeah, I don't like the use of that. I like to kind of punctuate the end of the chorus of the verse thing. I think that's a bit cheap and also kind of annoying on the ear. It's fine. I mean, as a first pop song by, you know, clearly trying to make, you know, another behemoth from the Billy Ray Cyrus production line, a.k.a. his
the
children.
The maestro. That is Billy Ray Cyrus.
Kids. It's grand. It didn't grab me. I saw a lot of people raving about it, and I was kind of left a little bit shrug emoji by the end of it.
I think it's, like, a good vocal performance. Like, I was very impressed that she's only 16, and I think that going forward that there is something there, but as you said, the production on it is just utter garbage. Like, I'll add to your water drops with that kind of faux air horn that sounds like a really, really awful attempt at the blood on the leaves towards the end of it.
It's not working
at all.
We like real air horns in this podcast.
Yeah, it's quite try hard. And she's been working with Max Martin as well, I believe. So it's just going to be, okay, who are the people we can get in to make these hits? And do we really need this?
What do we reckon Max Martin charges and like, you know, per hour?
No
15
idea,
quid at least.
Living wage, yeah. Well, if Max Martin's on board, she'll have at least one big hit, I would suspect, because he's kind of good at that thing. Mm. We got two songs left. Who hasn't picked a number yet?
Josh.
No, I did.
Oh, Josh did. Yeah. Dave, sorry.
I'm sorry, Dave. I apologize.
Number one.
Okay. This is Soul Wax with Transient Program for Drums and Machinery. Off the tongue, that one. 8 minutes long. It's a bit of a belter. Dave Higgins.
It is so good to have Soul Wax back. I think one of the worst things that ever happened is the success of Too Many DJs. Just because, you know, back when they made Much Against Everyone's Advice, we always talk about a lack of good rock bands around. Like, you'll be hard pushed to find a better rock record than that in like the last 15-20 years. but then they kind of had the success doing remixes, and then suddenly it just seemed like that they couldn't be anything but an electronic act. I know this is, again, in the electronic arena, but yeah, it's just fantastic. It's got like such a good momentum building. It kind of feels like a first track in the kind of vein of Get Innocuous.
Yes, very much so.
So if this is what's to come, I'm very excited for it.
And fucking, they're going to be bringing three drummers out on tour.
Yeah.
One of them big being man.
Igor Cavalera of Sepultura fame.
The best metal drummer?
Oof.
Best name for a metal drummer at the very least.
Ah, come on, lads. Lars. We'll be talking about him in a minute.
I don't know, Big Igor.
He's the best metal drummer I've ever watched live.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, this is great. And it kind of starts off, like, it's that build and that you're kind of like, okay, you know, this is fine. You mentioned Get Innocuous. I've heard this before. But when it clicks in and it gets going, those last 3 minutes or so.
Yeah, it's about 3.5 minutes before this really gets going. And before that, I'd been really skeptical because thematically, it was going a bit Pet Shop Boys, Sad Robot World again. Lest we forget.
Forgot about that, actually.
And more to the point, and I don't want to sound like True Detective here, but like literally the flat time, you know, when he sings time, just like that semitone off, that bugged the hell out of me for the first minute and a half of this song. I literally couldn't hear anything else other than waiting for him to go time. And you're like, no, you missed that one. Go back.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, they turned it around.
There is a kind of Kraftwerkian element to this. And yeah, it does start off, it seems a bit linear or something. Like it might be a bit flat, but has this great momentum. And it really, really does pay off. Unlike, say, the Piss Gene song. This is just, you know, by the end, you're like, yes, this is a proper belter. Mm-hmm. And I would echo Dave's comments that, you know, it's great to have them back. I mean, they've been around, but they haven't been doing soul wax. It's been over a decade, I guess, since we had proper material from them. And just, yeah, I mean, I love Too Many DJs Live, but it's great to have soul wax back.
Listening to it for the first time, it reminded me of listening to like Dance Yourself Clean for the first time, in terms of that kind of sitting around, kind of being like, oh, where is this going?
Yeah.
And then it's sort of kicking in and be like, oh, okay, this is where it was going. This is deadly.
Yeah, I think it's a home run, and I hope they play Dublin. I presume that they will. One band who are playing Dublin for the final ever time on the 18th of December are Enemies, a band that have been around for several years now. And this is their last ever single off their upcoming last ever album. It's called Glow, and it features Louise Gaffney of Come On Live Long on vocals, and it sounds a bit like this. Taken from Valuables, which comes out on the 9th of December. 9th of December is a very interesting day for Irish music because this comes out. Fight Like Apes play their last ever show in Dublin, and Overhead the Albatross headline Vicar Street. So kind of a, you know, bittersweet day really for a lot of people.
Yeah.
This album documents a turbulent time for the band. Intensive writing, recording and touring coupled with a lack of shared vision, which led to a decision that harmony in ending is ultimately more valuable than discord in continuing. So yeah, very interesting. Before we get to the song, I mean, like, Enemies, Round the Horn, I thought they were a really, really good band. I thought the second album in particular, Embark Embrace, was excellent. However, we have seen a lot of bands kind of fall by the wayside, bands like Enemies, bands like Halves, you know, bands that kind of, you know, challenge the listener and don't just give you, you know, radio-friendly, you know, A, B, C choruses. I guess it makes sense that they're wrapping up, and I don't mean that in any kind of, you know, disparaging way.
Yeah.
Kind of gone as far as they can go, I guess.
It's a tough, like, post-rock is a tough gig to kind of keep going in. Like, when you look at post-rock bands that have had some manner of success from Ireland, you kind of look to, and so you watch them afar, probably up there, but their success was the fact that they never stopped touring,
yeah,
which has got to be intensely difficult to do. So, yeah, Enemies, I think, were one of the best, and the first record we've been talking, I think, was like probably one of the better Richter records. Like, not better, because they're all quite good, but I think underappreciated, kind of, out of BC, always kind of got the hype.
Yeah.
But I think their guitar tones on that are just absolutely gorgeous. And this song is like a really kind of interesting departure for them. It kind of has like a real dream pop vibe to it that it I does, just wasn't expecting at all. And for them to kind of go in a completely different direction on their last record, I think, is a really interesting thing to do.
Very admirable, and it's a lovely, lovely song. Again, like it's not kind of, it doesn't have that signature Enemies kind of, you mentioned like even their signature guitar sound there, and that's fine for them. I mean, you want the last record to be a little bit different and not just be more of the same. And yeah, it's a shame that they're winding down, but like bands like them, bands like ABC, I do feel like they can only go so far. And we saw ABC obviously split off into All Twins, which is a much more commercial outfit, and though we weren't particularly enamored by that record, you know, they did sell out the Olympia, they are making money, and you can't begrudge any Irish act to want to go make a living in a different capacity. Craig, I know you're a fan.
I am a fan, yeah. Particularly if we've been talking, I think, as Dave says, that it's just so underrated, and I think it's one of the best records, Irish records of the last decade, maybe. It's just a gorgeous sounding record. They've always had that beautiful kind of sonic palette. And again, this is, you know, while it's a departure, it's true to that kind of great taste they've always had. I mean, it just sounds beautiful. And when they talk about like the being harmonious and ending, it does sound like a very harmonious song. I don't know if it's quite like it's too indelible. I don't know if it really stamps its kind of or makes its mark in any great way. But certainly when you're listening to it, it's a lovely listen.
I think as a teaser for the overall record, sure, that we know is coming, like they could have really put out anything. And I don't mean, again, to like dismiss this track or anything, but ultimately I think it's a case of, you know, like they probably feel that they can finally just play it safe now and do whatever the hell they want. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
To an extent, yeah. I think as well, though, if we know it is their last single. I don't know where it sits on the album, but if it even were to be a closing track, then, you know, I think it's quite suitable for that, really.
Sure.
And yeah, I enjoyed it.
Well, let's get into a band which, you know, again, we talk about bands who could have wrapped it up at some point. Some bands have crazy longevity. Metallica. Now, when Metallica announced this record was coming out on the podcast a few months ago, how we laughed.
How we laughed.
It was called Hardwired Self-Destruct. It had song titles like Am I Savage?
Yeah.
Confusion. Man Unkind. Here Comes Revenge.
Murder One.
Spit Out the Bone.
There was going to be a deluxe edition that had a third disc of Riff Origins.
Sounds dreadful. We're thinking, okay. Really. So yeah, how we laugh then, how we laugh now. Let's have a quick listen and we'll come back in just a moment. So that's Moth Into Flame, and we'll get into that song in a moment. But for now, is the joke on us, lads?
I don't know. I mean, I must say that there were some very encouraging signs from the singles that we heard. We did think that, yeah, we'd kind of maybe got it wrong. Listening to the album, though, it sounds like a band past their peak trying in vain to recapture former glories, for me.
I think they recapture former glories in parts. And the interesting thing with this is, they've come so close to making what I think is a very, very good record, and then they've gone with two discs. It's kind of like the album title where it's Hardwired to Self-Destruct. No, just stick to maybe Hardwired. That would mean grand. You know, you're getting back to your roots. You're being a bit edgy. But no, they always go too far, Metallica. But if they had just put out disc one, you would have been like, they're back. Disc two becomes quite self-indulgent. All the tracks, well, sorry, title track aside, most of them go way past the five-minute mark. And because it's thrash metal, I mean, it can be quite monotonous at times when they just get into a groove. So there are long passages where not too much
bloated.
Inspiring is happening. Having said that, there's some great moments on it.
I'm right there with you. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, if this had just been six songs, one disc, and it had ended a Halo on Fire, I'd be like, this is great. I'd be like, they've actually nailed it. They're having fun. The self-indulgence makes sense. It's really aggressive and over the top. I mean, like, this is technically their first album since 2008.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to talk about the record that killed Lou Reed that they brought out. So, you know, the last album proper Metallica is Death Magnetic in 2008, which is this fucking grimdark piece of crap, which everyone like was like, they're back! Because people hated Saint Anger. Now, the one tragedy about this record, Hardwired Self-Destruct, of course, I think we can all agree, is that Lars Ulrich's snare drum from Saint Anger is not employed here. But, you know, you can't...
Sorry, I was cooking that evening. I must have been...
you can't have everything, can you?
I knew you were going to bring up Saint Anger, so
Stanger,
because it's a really good album.
Oh shit!
Oh god! So I was driving to work today, and I was like, "I'm firing it up." I fired up Saint Anger. I watched Some Kind of Monster last night.
What a film! What a film!
It's an incredible film. Saint Anger is utter trash. I talked to my friend who was the most
thrash metal.
It's not even thrash metal, and that's kind of what I want to talk about with this record. Is this is Metallica going back to making a Metallica record. I think this is their best record since Injustice for All.
Ooh.
Yeah. Because I kind of feel that they... I'm not a big fan of the Black Album, but I kind of feel like they were looking to try and hit a classic rock, and then they kind of tried to adapt with the times a little bit too much with Load and Reload. They were looking at alt rock, and they were looking at Smashing Pumpkins and Nine Inch Nails and Alice in Chains and trying to do something like that. Saint Anger is pure nu metal. They looked at System of a Down and they looked at Slipknot, and they were just like, riffs are out. And funnily enough, in Some Kind of Monster, Kirk Hammett is talking. He's kind of... He basically has nothing to do in the entire film. I feel so bad for him.
He's the mediator. He's like, hey guys, come on. Stop fighting.
There's one point where he says...
Like, he rides a white horse at one point as well.
Yeah, and surfs.
What a film.
Not a euphemism.
But he argues against the whole idea is that James and Lars were like, no riffs, because that's the sound right now. And they were like,
no
if we,
tunes,
if
guys.
We put riffs in it, you know, it's so dated. And Kirk's argument was that if we don't put riffs in it, it's going to sound so dated. And he was 100% right. So now they've kind of gone back to just making a record that they would have made in the late 80s.
Yeah.
And I think it's...
Ironically, apparently Kirk had little to no input in this entire record.
Yeah, he lost his
iCloud,
iPhone.
Man.
And so therefore he lost all his sketches for the album. Josh, what did you make of it?
The question that...
Let's talk about Saint Anger first, though.
I think Saint Anger is a really good record. Okay. I will like listen to that. Like, it's like one of the only Metallica albums that I'll throw on and I'll listen to start to finish.
It's too long.
You're saying
it is too long.
It's way too long. I've had that thing with Saint Anger where I'm like, I'll defend that record because, you know, I think it has some really good stuff on it. The Unnamed Feeling is great. The title track is excellent.
The title track has a good riff and that's it.
But the problem with that record is, I remember going to see Nine Inch Nails with my friends a few years ago in Belfast, and we were like, we're going to listen to Saint Anger in the car on the way up. And I remember like about two tracks in, I was like, someone should write a fucking think piece. I'm going to pitch to Pitchfork about this. You know, someone, we really need an in defense of Saint Anger. And about three songs later, I was like, can we turn it off, please? Because it's just, they can't end the song. Now, they're guilty of that on this as well, but in a much more egregious way in Saint Anger. But overall, Josh, you're a Saint Anger fan. A Saint Anger stan, if you will.
I am. And the question that kind of kept running through my head listening to this record was,
am I savage?
After that.
Or was, are we Dancer?
Was which of these songs is Triple H most likely to come out to at WrestleMania this year?
Oh, wow.
And I think, personally, it's Am I Savage?
So do I. Absolutely, I do. I do, because as well, it's one of the only points in this album where you actually have that classic Metallica thing of a slow burn build-up. And that's one of the things that disappointed me about this record, that a lot of the songs, and initially we actually thought it was a positive. It lashed straight in. There was little enough fat on it. It had no time to be self-indulgent or meandering. You know, it had a good riff and off we go.
But the tempo stays the same.
Precisely. The problem is you're still there 7 minutes later. It used to be the fact that, you know, like it might be 2 minutes before you get any sort of real payoff in a Metallica song because you have a nice slow build up. That song, Am I Savage? Like, I'm listening to it and I'm thinking, like, you know, 30 years ago, that build-up would have been a barnstormer, whereas now it's just a bit of a twiddly 50 seconds to kind of build into it. Like, if that was Blackened, if that was Battery, if that was one of those classic songs where you're just like, okay, holy shit, this is going to kick off. Now,
but I think you do get that,
anymore.
Though. Yeah. I think you get that. With, like, I mean, for example, I think Moth Into Flame is, I'm putting it out there, guys, I think Moth Into Flame is one of the best songs of the year.
I would disagree. It's a very good song, though. It is a very good song.
I think it's excellent. I think it's so fucking joyous. I think it does its job incredibly well. I think it's musically fantastic. I think Hetfield, by the way, on this record.
Great.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do we reckon this is production or he's just done something? Because he sounds a bit fucking 20 years younger and he sounds excellent.
I've seen some kind of live things they've done recently and he just seems way into it again.
What so the hell
it
has
seems
happened?
I do not know, but yeah, he just totally
he has
steals
more
his album.
Command on his vocals here than I've heard in I don't know how long.
Yeah.
And, you know, granted, the lyrics are still ridiculous because it's James Hetfield and Metallica. But Moth Into Flame in particular, I think is phenomenal. I think it's a phenomenal song. And I think the first six songs generally are very, very strong. Atlas Rise is great crack.
It's fantastic.
The last 2 minutes of Halo on Fire, you're just like, end the album like this.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe you'd put Spit Out the Bone is great.
Fantastic.
Stick that on the first disc.
Yeah, great, yeah.
Stick that on the first disc and you're good to go. That's a 45-minute album. It's like, everyone's just like, holy shit, one of the albums
songs,
of the year. Yeah.
You'd be like, this is their best album maybe ever. You'd be like they well, just, well, you know, up there for sure. I mean, like, I think, you know, Atlas Rise, when that came out, Dave, you were like, it's 3 minutes too long.
Now it's one of my favorite songs in the album.
There you go.
It just...
Is that a comparative thing to the rest of the songs of the album, though? I'm not sure, because, like, I mean, like, elsewhere, that like the following song, Now That We're Dead, now that's 3 minutes too long.
I think it's really good.
It's a great song.
And I think, like, you know, parts of those first song, like the callback to Enter Sandman, I think it's Am I Savage or Hell on Fire kind of reminds me of Slipknot's Dead Memories, of all things. They managed to kind of evoke a certain style here without being too, you know, either self-referential or even ripping off other bands. There's just like nice little hints of it. When you get into disc two, though, it's when it kind of loses me. And I found that I had to kind of listen to the record by splitting it. I had to, like, take a break after the first six and listen to something else. The new Busted record, actually.
I was going back and forth between this and Leonard Cohen in preparation for the episode.
That must have been difficult.
It was jarring, to say the very least.
Yeah, I can see now why you were unsettled by the Leonard Cohen record. but no, with disc two, you know, Confusion, Dream No More, Man Unkind, Jesus Christ, Here Comes Revenge, Murder One, Spit Out the Bone, it's just too much. And it gets too tiring. Like, the record as a whole is almost an hour and 20 minutes long.
It's their second longest record. Do you know what their longest record is?
Ooh.
Load.
Saint Anger.
Load.
Yeah.
Really?
Load. Yeah,
that's a fucking load.
Yeah. Humongous album.
Is Fuel on that?
No, Reload.
Fuel's a great song.
Yeah.
Avril Lavigne doing a terrible cover of it. Overall, I find with this record that it's... Disc one is the fun, well-executed, self-indulgent side of Metallica. Disc two is the, you didn't need this at all. You know, like, there's nothing on here that I would say is outright terrible. There's nothing on here that justifies some of these terrible titles. There's nothing on here where I was like, this is crap. I was just like, I've kind of had enough now, guys. And, like, I don't know, maybe metal fans will be delighted by this. Maybe they'll be like, it's the first proper Metallica record in 8 years and we really wanted this giant feast. For me, I will probably not listen to disc two, but I will definitely return to disc one a lot.
Do you know what this record needs? And I know that Rick Rubin produced their last record, and I think Greg Fiddleman does a great job in this because he kind of just lets them make the record and kind of doesn't really inject himself in.
Yeah.
This needs the Rick Rubin Yeezus treatment, where he just comes in, where they brought it to him, and it's like, you're not with us in the studio, and they just present it to him, and then he's like, lose that. And then maybe you could lean it down to, if this was an 8-song record,
yeah, just get Rick in towards the end. Just get him to lie on a couch for a couple of hours and just go, no, get rid of it. Yeah, that totally would have worked.
Yeah, I feel as though, like, not only is the record too long, but like, there's also just nowhere near the ideas that you need to fill some of the song structures that they were trying to go for here, or that they should have been trying to go for.
They were all on Kirk's phone.
Yeah. at the same time, I do agree. Like, this is by no means a terrible record. I think the ultimate judge is this, okay? And because, like, I was a big Metallica fan as a teenager. If I knew a 15-year-old now, like, who wanted to get a Metallica album and was going to buy this one, I would not lose my mind.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And, like, that's one thing. That's a big thing to say for a band who, like you say, maybe made their best album, what is it, 27 years ago now? Or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a big thing to say that, you know, okay, actually, it's not that bad.
What if the 15-year-old came back to you and said, they were sold out of that one, I got this one with a big red fist on the cover?
Yeah, you see, that's going right
it's better than the one with the semen on the cover.
That's going right in the bin, and we're getting Puppets and Justice from my CD collection.
What one has semen on the cover?
Load. And Reload, I think, Reload. As well. Yeah, God, they were just really? Close-ups of, yeah.
Craig was just really excited when he bought the record. They're not printed. Josh?
I think overall, I'd probably agree. Like, I mean, this one definitely has its moments. Overall, I kind of had a very hollow feeling coming from the record, that it was sort of Metallica trying to be, you know, this sort of image of what Metallica is supposed to be, and that there was no real sort of progression in terms of the sound. Now, obviously, they've tried progression before, and people were not too pleased about it.
Some of us were.
Well, the Lou Reed album as well.
Oh, Jesus.
But, like, it's definitely a good record. I just feel like it's probably going to be easily forgotten because it doesn't really offer anything that Metallica hasn't offered before.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've offered their fans a lot with this record. Money was spent. They released like 12 music videos, mm-hmm. like, you know, to coincide with it. Actually, no, they released 13.
Yeah.
Because at one point I was like, hang on, like they released a track called Lords of Summer, and to borrow from my friend Dave pointing this out, Lords of fucking Summer, lads. You're like in your 50s. Like, what the hell?
I think the one thing about this album is if you saw them live, you wouldn't be like, oh, they're doing one of the new songs. You'd actually be quite excited to hear some of these songs live. So that's, you know,
they played
Moth and
Flame on like Fallon or something, and it was excellent.
Yeah.
If they announced a gig tomorrow, I'd go. That's
I agree.
On the strength of those first six songs, at least, I would want to see them live. I want to see them again. I'm going to say 7 out of 10. And to be fair, if you had said to me like when we announced that this record was coming out, that you'd be giving this record 7 out of 10 and feeling a little bit like, am I savage? Am I lowballing it? It's a strong.
I'm madly in anger with you right now.
It's a strong 7 for me. And legitimately, guys, I hope Moth into Flame gets into the No Encore Top 20 Songs of the Year, but we'll see.
I'm going to give it a 7.5.
Ooh.
They're back.
Yeah, it's an 8 for disc 1 with kind of 7. It drags down to about a 7, yeah.
Wow, these are high scores. I'm going 6. I don't think it hits quite as much as
I can see
do.
Why you go 6. That's fair enough.
I'm also going to get 6. Going to go for 6. And I'm also
going to get 6.
And I'm also brought back to that. Remember, Dave, the world of no 7s? Where it's really easy to give something 7 out of 10. So in a world of no 7s, is it a 6 or an 8?
It's a 6.
Exactly.
Fuck
okay.
you. Also, where did that come from, by the way?
It's Neil A. Patel of the Verge podcast.
It's really good.
Yeah, because it forces people to a real decision. It's so easy, like, oh, it's a 7. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're a fucking asshole. Well, one album that I gave 6 out of 10 to, are you happy now, Josh?
Delighted.
Is the new Busted record, Night Driver.
Hold on, you gave it a 6?
I gave it a 6. Hey, who's heard it for the last 2 weeks and who hasn't? Yeah, shut your fucking mouth. But I'm kidding. It's okay. It's good to have you in the podcast. I'm glad you're here. Yeah, if I was going to recommend other things to listen to, I'd recommend you give Busted album a go. It's weird. Like, granted, my review is full of snark, and I quite enjoyed writing it, and took a lot of shots. And I also mentioned some new metal in there, so it's a weird little review. But 6 out of 10 for Busted's new album, Night Driver, which is doesn't sound anything like they used to. Sounds like they listened to a lot of Maroon 5 and Daft Punk. Sounds like they went to LA. Sounds like they hired big writers and made songs that they don't really have any identity in. But, you know, pop music is strange, and it's coming off the Robbie Williams terrible album. It's nice to hear some male-driven pop that's, while not about a lot, at least well-executed. So if I was going to recommend you pick up something this week, go and listen to Busted. Lads, anything else?
I haven't heard much else to speak, to be honest.
I'm still rinsing that Robbie Williams record, to be honest. Some whopper jams.
You're gonna give out to me about Schoolboy Q, aren't you?
No, well, look, listen to that album already, but I haven't got to spend a lot of time with it, but A Tribe Called Quest's 6th and possibly final record, we got it from here, thank you for your service, is really, really good. Again, kind of, I know we were talking about hearing someone for the last time, and just getting to hear Fife Dog one more time is phenomenal. The production on it is great. Kind of Q-Tip is incredibly underrated in that regard. And it's got a slew of really good guests. Andre 3000 and Kendrick and Man of the Year. Anderson .Paak's in there as well. So I take over that.
Praise indeed. Well, first of all, thanks very much, guys, for coming in. Thank all of you for
being
here.
Thank you,
Dave. Really appreciate it, as always. Listeners, if you are a fan of this podcast, I would ask you to do the annoying thing of rating and reviewing us on iTunes if you are an iTunes subscriber. And if you're not, why not? Subscribe, you know? It's kind of one of those weird things. It'll take you no time at all. If you like the show, give us a good rating and say something nice, because it does actually fucking boost the profile of the program, and even some of the biggest podcasts ask their listeners to do so. So I don't feel too bad about doing so. But to play us out this week, an incredible song, if you ask me. A band that appeared on the very first episode, were huge fans of Overhead the Albatross. They play Vicar Street on the 9th of December to, I guess, promote that gig / reflect the times that we live in. I don't know how long the song was in the works. They recorded a cover of Hans Zimmer's Time from Inception, which I'm sure everyone knows and really enjoys. It's an excellent piece of music, and they've done a bit of a twist on it in that they have used the speech from the end of Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, and they've used it to great effect. Have we all had a chance to listen to it, by the way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Super.
I think it's absolutely magnificent. Like, kind of goosebumps, a tear in my eye, Dave. A tear in my eye.
Dave's actually talking to himself there.
Higgins Flair. Remains unmoved.
Higgins remains unmoved would be in a phenomenal autobiography, wouldn't it?
It's definitely going to make an awesome pod title.
So. Higgins remains unmoved. I like it, yeah. Well, we'll see. We have options. But Ric Flair, tear in my eye. That's me. Yeah, so to play us out this week, Overhead the Albatross's Cover of Time, I recommend you listen to this all the way through. It's fucking beautiful. And check out the video that they recorded in Vicar Street with the excellent Bull Puppy behind them. It's fantastic. An amazing band and an amazing song. Sadly relevant, but brilliant nonetheless. My name is Dave Hanratty. This has been No Encore. There will be no encore. Later.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes, men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines, you are not cattle, you are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate, only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world, that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason. A world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
HPN, the Headstuff Podcast Network. See headstuff.org for more details.